Welcome to the 8th edition of Vox Populi, the show by atheists for atheists. Twice a month, our team answers questions on various issues relevant to the atheist life. In this episode, we discuss absolute truth, the consilience of science and religion, bestiality, and ex-atheists. Our first question is, if the universe could somehow communicate the absolute truth to you about any single issue, what would you ask it and why?
If the universe could somehow communicate the absolute truth to me about anything, I'd probably ask it about itself. I mean, hey, if I'm getting the absolute truth, I might as well go for the whole enchilada and ask for the absolute truth. And admittedly, given the connected nature of all facts, it would probably end up with that in the end anyway. I mean, let's say I asked it about the chemical structure of Twinkie filling. Well, that would get into chemistry, pastries, the Hostess Company, America, etc. In theory, every single atom in existence once shared the same virtually zero-dimensional space at one point. So the absolute truth about just about anything is the absolute truth of just about everything.
Well, if I'm allowed an answer to what essentially boils down to be my greatest curiosity, I would choose to know the exact nature of how our universe was born and, if my instincts prove to be correct, how indeed all universes form in a multiverse. Is there, as I suspect, variation in origin and nature of innate laws and properties? Are all universes capable of creating energy and matter independently? Or is there a cumulative effect or specific conditions or laws necessary found only in specific models? Is a universe the creation of new dimensions in an existing universe due to the breakdown in physics caused by a singularity like a black hole? Would that make a black hole a big crunch for an expired universe? Or do universes evolve independently amongst infinite stretches of vacuous nothingness because of an infinitesimal number of subatomic particles of matter somehow escaping annihilation with subatomic particles of antimatter causing uneven variation and hence energy, matter, gravity, and temperature in what is otherwise absolutely nothing? Does this count as one question? This is why I love science. As Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, to be master of any branch of knowledge, you must master those which lie next to it, and to thus know anything, you must know all. It seems like the more I learn, the more I realize there is I don't know.
I hope you'll excuse the length of this response, but this is a topic that I work with every day, and I personally find it extremely fascinating. I hope you will too. I mean, after all, a sentient universe is quite an interesting proposition. But I take this question in the metaphorical sense of, what would you hope to learn about the universe? I.e., by empiricism, really. There are tons of things I'd like to learn, as I'm sure you would too, but one thing specifically takes the cake. Far and away takes the cake, and here's my question for the universe. How do polarized sunglasses work? I know, it doesn't seem like such a big issue, but I guess I should explain myself. See, a polarized sunglasses basically keeps reflected light from shining in your eyes, right? You wear it out on the water, and the reflection isn't so bright. Unfortunately, the situation's not quite as simple as it might seem, but a little bit of background is necessary so that you're all on the same page with me here, and all I'm basically asking is that you just think through this while you listen. Just try to picture what I'm saying. You could even draw it out on paper, that might help too, because it can get kind of complicated and visualizing it simplifies things. So, we start out with light, and it's a well-known idea that light is a bunch of tiny little particles, right? And you can think of a beam of light as millions and billions of tiny little points of energy, just little tiny points, and they're just energy, and they rush across the universe, and they move very fast. And each little point, aka we call it a photon, has a couple of really important properties, and that's what I want you to visualize. So, okay, picture this. We have a little photon, and zooming across space, so it's just moving basically straight. It can maybe shake a little bit, turn a little bit, and something needs to propel it. That's a basic idea. It's got to be moved by something. And we call the things that propel it E field and B field, and it's not important what they are really, but they sort of just twist around it, and here's how they do it. They're little lines, and they come off of the photon. They're always 90 degrees to each other. So if the E field is up, then the B field is either left or right. and we don't really know which, but it's one or the other. They move around the photon in a circle, basically. So the E field starts at the top and goes to the left, and then the B field is pointing up at that point. So that's basically what our understanding of light is necessary for this discussion anyway. So polarized light is a sort of specific batch of light. You've cooked up this batch of photons, and it has this property that the E fields of some photons spin completely opposite and synchronously the other photons. So let's say you have two E fields of different photons pointing up, then a little bit later, one's pointing left and the other's pointing right. So they're spinning sort of oppositely, but synchronously. So that when the E fields are lined up, that direction is called the direction of polarization. So that's where it's polarized, maybe vertical or horizontal, something like that. So now take your polarized sunglasses and polarize your light in one direction with one lens. So you take one lens and put it horizontal polarized. Now the lens comes out and it's all horizontal polarized. Now you put the other after it, the other lens, rotate 90 degrees. So now it's blocking vertical light. So obviously all of the light is gone. First you block the horizontal, then you block the vertical, it's all gone. Now, just think about one photon. Its E field points in some direction, doesn't matter which one, points in some direction, but it's not lined up with another E field of another photon. If we put it through a polarizer, what do you think happens? Because it's going to come in one, and it's not lined up with anything, so it's not polarized, and go right through, right? Not quite. A single photon, still, if we put it through both lenses, will never come out the other side, ever. A single photon, even though it's not polarized with anything else, it has to spin both clockwise and counterclockwise. It has to do two things at once, but it can't possibly do both. It can't do one, it can't do the other. How can it do both? This is just amazing, this problem. I mean, we have a single photon of light exhibiting properties that only two photons or more can exhibit. How can it do this? It's just a really crazy question, and it's part of this relatively new field of quantum mechanics, of physics called quantum mechanics. And it's not just polarizers, it's all over the place with electrons and all other little tiny particles that we don't know too much about. But that's just what I would ask the universe. Just how it can act in this manner where something cannot be A, cannot be B, cannot be both, and cannot be neither. And it exhibits properties of all of the above. How can it do this? Well, I think that's just a crazy question, and honestly, what better question is there to ask something which we're all a part of and know relatively nothing about? Just what the hell are you?
Many people on both sides of the fence promote consilience between science and religion. Do you agree? If so, how do you think it would work? If not, why not?
Hell no, I don't agree. Whenever there's a conflict between science and religion, it's always religion that should take the back seat. And that's because religion is about faith, it's about wishing, it's about whims and desires. Science is about finding out what's real around us. Science is about finding out the truth of the existence that we exist in. And existence has primacy over consciousness. In other words, the reality of the world we live in has primacy or takes prerogative over the wishes that we have. I can really wish that I don't need to eat foods to survive, but science is always going to trump that faith or that wish and tell me that, well, in fact, I need to consume energy to spend it, and that's going to come in the form of food. People's wishes always get dashed when reality comes knocking at their door. Never does someone pit their mere desires against reality and come out on top. Only through direct physical action can you ever hope to accomplish anything in terms of making existence conform to what you really want. So science always trumps religion, because reality always trumps wishes.
I really don't know what it means to reconcile science and religion. They're two completely different enterprises. Science is the process by which the complexity of reality is made simple through the discovery of discrete but interrelated facts. Religion is the process by which the simplicity of discrete but interrelated facts is made complex through the discovery of theological principles. They're completely opposed in practice and in principle. Science is based on empiricism, and religion is based on faith. Now, some people are able to, through radical partitioning of their intellect to pursue science and religion concurrently. But I know nothing of what it would mean to be religiously scientific or scientifically religious. In the former, I can perhaps imagine a scientist beginning each day by praying to the gods of biology, chemistry, and physics, which, by the way, is not too dissimilar to what I used to do before finals in college, hanging a gold-plated double helix above his doorpost in reverence, or meeting together with his fellow scientists once a week to sing songs about how wonderful gravity is. Now, on the latter, I can imagine a minister testing the stories in his Bible to determine if they're repeatable, preparing an experiment to see if his parishioners are more or less likely to sin if they receive grape juice instead of wine during communion, and searching through the Bible to discover any new theological principles that explain reality better than those which were formerly held by his religion. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous. No scientist that acted that way would ever make any discoveries, and no minister that acted that way would ever maintain his faith. The two are mutually exclusive. The best thing for science would be for religion not to exist, and vice versa. Anyone who thinks that he can rationally combine the two is fooling himself.
When I think of the word consilience, I think of that book by E.O. Wilson called Consilience, but he's talking about a unification of the various sciences, branches of science. And I can see that happening right now, even as we specialize more and more, but I cannot see consilience between science and religion. And the reason is because you've got science over here talking about reality, and changing their views of reality based on the evidence and what they learn. And then on the other hand, you have religion, which is trying to make reality like it wants it to be. And these are two fundamentally different ways of looking at reality. One of them makes sense, the former, and the other doesn't. So there can't really be any conciliation or any unification of religion and science in the way that they're structured now. If religion became something that was fundamentally rational, that might be a strange way of thinking about it, but if it became rational in some way, for example, not being based on blind faith or not being true despite the evidence, then yeah, that would have some sort of a connection to science. But at that point, it sort of becomes science.
I found that almost all discussions of science and religion fail to understand both. Can science and religion be made consilient? If we discover something to be true and both agree with it, they're consilient. If we find something to be false and one still clings to it, then they're not consilient. So, if both science and religion submit to the facts, there's no problem. One of the two does not, however. The most fundamental problem with all these well-wishing proponents of peace between science and religion is that they don't understand what religion is. Most basically of all, they are usually not talking about religion, but about Christianity. But why should we spend a lot of time marrying Christianity and science if Christianity is not the only religion in the world? Why not ask if we can integrate Buddhism in science, or Islam in science, or belief in tree spirits in science? The very discussion is either uninformed or dishonest. This is important because the various religions don't agree with each other on most critical issues. So even if we did make peace between one of them in science, it would still leave out and probably contradict all the others. Case in point. Hinduism claims that the universe is billions of years old, and that it's periodically destroyed and replaced with a new one. That belief actually sounds something like the Big Bang and Big Crunch model of physics. We could achieve a consilience between Hinduism and science on this question, I guess, but it will still ignore or reject the belief of at least some Christians that the universe is young, and that it has been and will be created only once. And other smaller and more obscure religions make other claims about the origin of humans, the creation of the universe, the nature of an afterlife, and so on, that could not all be made compatible with each other, let alone with science, at the same time. So if we're honest and admit that we're talking about blending Christianity with science, we see one major problem. It's hugely arrogant and ignorant. Most of the world is not Christian and could care less about that project. We can still ask whether a religious perspective in general could be made compatible with a scientific one, however. There are two crucial ways to look at this question. First, science and religion, whatever that means, are only in combat when they disagree. When they agree, nobody has any problems with either. We cannot say that all religion is all right or all wrong, each is right about some things and wrong about others. How do we know? Because we gather the facts, arrive at conclusions, in other words, do the science. Science is the ultimate and only court for deciding what is true about factual questions. How old is the Earth? The real point is not the answer, but how you arrive at an answer. Do you look at an old book, or do you look at the Earth? The difference is the difference between religion and science. The second crucial problem is about the real difference between religion and science. The difference is not in the details, like how old the Earth is, or even how humans emerged. A religion could claim a very old or a very young Earth and still be religion. The key issue is that religion attributes things to beings and forces that are inherently personal, like gods or nature spirits or dead ancestors or ascended masters or what have you. All religions posit a kind of agency, that is, an intelligence, a will, a personality, that is behind or involved in events. So, religious explanations, if we can call them that, are ultimately reasons. For what reason did the beings and or forces do that? For instance, a Christian might ask, and would have to ask, why did God do that? Why did he let that person die or make that hurricane? Science doesn't work that way. Science does not seek to explain phenomena in personal terms. It does not look for reasons, but rather for causes. Science can ask what caused that hurricane, but it does not, and it cannot, ask for what reason was that hurricane made. I said that science not only does not but cannot seek personal, agent-based explanations. Why? First, because personality or agency cannot be detected and observed in any meaningful way. I can watch a person and see what he or she does. However, if I was alone in a room and something moved, it would be stupid to attribute that action to a person in the room, since there is no person in the room. Unless we can see the agent, we cannot assert any agency. And the simple proof of this is that different religions assert different agents. God, Allah, Vishnu, Zeus, Odin, tree spirits, fairies, leprechauns, and so on forever. They're all unfounded and almost certainly wrong. Second, personality makes events unpredictable and irregular. Natural forces, the kind science seeks, which are not persons, do not have their own reasons and motivations and desires. Therefore, they're regular. The same cause always leads to the same results. However, persons or agents act for personal reasons, so they may act differently in the same circumstances. That is the nature of freedom. So, if in fact there are supernatural persons or minds behind reality, it makes reality essentially unknowable to us, since they might act one way one day and another way another day. So in the end, science and religion are not even up to the same things. Science looks for causes which are necessarily natural. Religion looks for reasons which are necessarily non-natural. Religion then is not so much a competitor with science as an extra, an unnecessary and unfounded layer or dimension of explanation. Look at it this way. Science might explain a hurricane in terms of winds and temperatures and such, and then religion could add on, and God did it. How does the religious explanation help? My final thought is this. Why should we want consilience between religion and science? I don't care about consilience, I care about truth. If something is wrong, it has to go. When religion is right, we should keep it. When it's wrong, we should toss it out. We don't coddle false scientific claims or theories, we junk them. If religion is wrong, and all religions are mostly wrong about most things, we should junk them.
What is your position on bestiality?
Bestiality is among humankind's standard list of taboos. For most, it ranks right up there with incest, cannibalism, and unfortunately, homosexuality. I think bestiality has always been seen as something unnatural and detrimental to society. I agree to a certain extent. Although I don't really like to use the term unnatural, it's a little misleading. Everything is natural in the sense that everything occurs in reality in a natural environment. We have knowledge based on history and personal experience of what behaviors and practices are good and bad for ourselves and humanity. I'm simply making the point that any good or bad behaviors or practices are natural. They just may not be morally or ethically acceptable to many. That being said, I don't personally have anything against bestiality. What you want to do behind closed doors in private is none of my business. However, I don't know what kind of harm that could do to someone. I suppose physically you would have to worry about hurting yourself or the animal, or maybe sickness or disease. I would be more concerned with the possible psychological issues surrounding the impetus to boink farm animals and the like. Bestiality, along with rape, molestation, sadomasochism, and fetishes, are the results of things like unhealthy sexual experiences, such as childhood molestation, or sexual repression. Some of these behaviors are obviously worse than others. Some can be healthy, in a way, such as a fetish or submissive dominance role-playing, but I believe they can all become unhealthy obsessions if one is not careful. Before civilizations, anything went. There was no repression of instincts. There was no governing law, until God was invented, to prohibit a man from raping a woman or animal. I'm glad we've come as far as we have in curbing some of our baser instincts with socially enforced codes or personal moral conduct. And I even think religion has had a big hand in refining what is considered acceptable behavior. Unfortunately, religion causes all types of sexual perversion and repression as well. We still have a long way to go before people understand why it is beneficial to them and everyone around them to live a moral life. We need to stop having the threat of God's wrath as the sole reason to be moral. We need more open discussion on what is moral or immoral and why, in an attempt to come closer to a consensus on topics like these. Bestiality is a good example. So is homosexuality. The subject of morality can be examined as critically as any subject, but until we no longer have religion pushing antiquated beliefs and practices, along with rigid and many times incorrect and counterintuitive moral behaviors and practices, we will continue to wonder why priests fondle little boys while opposing homosexuality and pig-fucking.
What is my position on bestiality? Could you have phrased that question any better? I think that's the best way to phrase that question. So I'm going to use a different word. I'm going to say, what is my stance on bestiality, so that I don't put myself in that position. But my stance is that I really don't care. I really don't think about it very much. You know, in Exodus and Leviticus, you're defiling yourself, and so it's making you dirty, you know, go wash your hands sort of mentality. It's a sin, but not because of any health concerns or any psychological damage, but just because God said don't do it. Now, it probably originated from some of those concerns, but, you know, I thought, why not go to the literature and see if there's anything about this? So I went to PubMed, and I've only found one article, if you type in the word bestiality, by a guy named Peter Singer, who I believe is a well-known philosopher who supports animal rights. He fights for animal rights. So that's really all I could find. I guess I would just reiterate the point that I don't care about having sex with animals, but, you know, if you want to and there's no health risk, you know, go right ahead. It's kind of stupid, but hey, if that's what you want to do, then do what you want.
Bestiality, to the extent that it does not constitute unwarranted torture, is not immoral. To single out bestiality as an immorality is to deny that humans are animals also. Oftentimes, it's the welfare of the animal that's brought up as the reason for it being immoral. Well, sure, some animals are highly distressed at having sex with humans, but others are quite happy to, and I know there are videos of it on the internet. But most people would condemn both as immoral, so it can't be the welfare of the animal that's at issue. I think the cultural stigma is similar to the stigma against incest and homosexuality. In all three, reproductive success of a population is threatened. In bestiality, the choice of a human to have sex with an animal means that less human children will be born. The same is more or less true with homosexuality. And with incest, the threat of mutation compounded with the complicated power relationships that are manufactured make it undesirable from a cultural standpoint. But an argument from effect is not an argument for morality. And ultimately, one has to consider that the same arguments against bestiality can apply to homosexuality. Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is the master of this, by the way. I don't think it's any coincidence that condemnations against all three of these so-called sexual deviancies are found in the same place in the Bible, Leviticus 18. So, is bestiality weird and gross? Well, yeah, pretty much. But is it immoral? Not at all.
Why are most, if not all, ex-atheist testimonies actually testimonies from people who were mad at religion, hated God, or otherwise accepted the existence of God?
Well, I think it's pretty clear when you look at the specifics of Christian theology, or even all the Abrahamic theologies. They say that everyone knows in their heart that God is real, and that non-believers are either self-deceiving or fools or some other ad hominem attack. So if there really is an atheist that converts back to a Christian or Abrahamic religion of some kind, he's going to look at it from a new perspective. He's going to think to himself, oh, I always believed in God all along, and I was just mad at him and mad at the world. But the truth is that they're doing a Big Brother revisionism type of thing, rewriting history in their own heads. Let's imagine for a second that some of those testimonies are faked, though, by Christians who are trying to promote their ministry. Well, then it still makes perfect sense in their eyes, because that's the way they see it, because they don't believe that atheists really exist. They believe that it's a rebellion against God rather than a rejection of the Christian claim. They always have to assume that their claim is like the starting point. I think, to a large degree, every Christian sits there and assumes that their belief in God is the axiomatic and fundamental obvious truth rather than some sort of claim that had to be supported.
I think you have to first ask the question, why do people embrace religions? Why do people want to be religious? From my standpoint, it's essentially a rejection of reason. They're saying, you know, a person who becomes religious is saying, I don't want to think for myself anymore. I don't understand why bad things happen, or life is too complex for me. So I'm just going to embrace this mysterious, incomprehensible higher power and let that take over my life, let that control me. I want to be a prisoner to this mystery because I can't understand what's going on. You know, and that's a fatalistic way to view life. I mean, that's not really living. That's denying yourself all the pleasures of life, hoping for something afterlife without having any conception of what that might be. So it makes sense from that standpoint that people who call themselves ex-atheists would write testimonies talking about what they've gotten from religion in terms of meaning and morality, and then contrast it with what they didn't have before they found that religion. And they often use very strong language to indicate that they're very secure in their religion and happy that they've adopted it. But the important point, what you have to take away as an atheist looking at these things, is that they've given up on life.
I think there's a mental disconnect in the way people relate atheism and Christianity. They think that atheists are anti-Christians, that the two are polar opposites of each other. They think that atheists are just people who hate Christianity, or Christians, and therefore hate God by proxy. What is kind of essential to making this assumption is the fact that, given this definition, atheists just aren't atheists. It seems pretty elementary to me, but apparently some people think that it is, in fact, possible to hate God even though you think he doesn't exist. And this, of course, is what makes no sense. An atheist either doesn't believe or lacks belief in a God or gods. It doesn't make any sense to talk about hating something that you don't believe in. Like saying that I hate Santa Claus because I found out that he didn't exist. It's completely ridiculous. The Christians who talk about being ex-atheists seem to all make this error, and show their hand inadvertently. I've never read a single testimony from one of these quote-unquote ex-atheists that doesn't mention hating God or Christians at some point. Take Paul Minotta of the blog Press the Antithesis as a brief example. He was raised in the church, had a very religious mother, accepted biblical teachings at a young age. Even though he rebelled against Christianity as he got older, his testimony belies his tacit acceptance of the existence of God. He, quote, hated Christians. He got into Satanism. It's pretty obvious that his rebellion against God was just a larger symptom of his rebellion against his father, and he eventually succumbed to the proselytizing of his religious mother. This is not someone who took a clear and rational stand against faith and irrationality, and I challenge anyone to show me an ex-atheist who didn't confuse rebellion with outright rejection.
Our team was Robert Dawson, Jake Doling, David Eller, Edward Grieve, Aaron Kinney, and Zachary Moore. An archive of this feature is available on hellboundalley.com/voxpopuli. If you would like to join the team, submit comments, or suggest new questions, email us at ally@hellboundalley.com. Thank you everyone for their great work, and we'll be back in 2 weeks for more insightful answers, this time on the topic of morality. This was Vox Populi, the voices of atheism.
I'm sure the animals don't think so.